Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show, a place where business and thought leaders come to weigh in on important sales-related topics that you can use in your sales career and life. I'm your host, Jason Cutter. My mission is to get your help in changing sales from something prospects fear to an act of service they actually seek out and appreciate. Whether you're in sales, leading sales teams, or own a business, I hope this helps you improve your selling effectiveness and you can go out into the world as an authentic persuader. Hey, everybody. So what you're about to hear is a conversation I had with Jeff Kerchek. We just did a live. I'm recording this right after we stopped our live broadcast on LinkedIn. It was on YouTube. It's on Facebook. By the way, if you're listening to this podcast and you're not connected to me or following me on those platforms, please do it. Make sure LinkedIn, you can find me YouTube as well as Facebook, Facebook business page for Cutter Consulting Group. Find me there, connect with me, follow, like this content, share it, hit the bell icon, all that stuff you hear all the time. Subscribe to this podcast if you're not, if this is the first episode. But what you're about to hear is the conversation that I just had with Jeff Kerchek. So it was kind of an interview because it was under my LinkedIn Live that we were streaming to, but it was more of an equal conversation. So here's the thing is I wrote a book that came out last year in August of 2020 called Selling with Authentic Persuasion, Transform from Order Taker to Quota Breaker. And Jeff, and I'm going to pull this up so I can read it specifically. Jeff wrote a book called Authentic Selling, How to Use the Principles of Sales in Everyday Life, which is amazing. And his book came out in December of 2020. And I think it's interesting and fascinating that the universe had two people write identical books. And of course, there's Larry Levine's Selling from the Heart. There's Bob Berg's Go-Giver series. And those came out before this. But to have two books about authentic sales, authentic selling, come out within a few months' time frame last year with everything going on, I think is just something amazing and powerful. And as soon as I saw that, instead of thinking, this guy's competition, he's doing the same thing, he wrote a book in the same way, I was like, we need to chat. And as soon as we started talking last week, I was like, we need to do a LinkedIn Live. Let's just start doing some content. Let's put more and more of this out there. It's the same thing. Like when I was writing my book, everyone was like, oh, yeah, Larry Levine wrote the same thing. It's called Selling from the Heart. And Bob Berg wrote The Go-Giver. Like, you should read those. And I was like, no, I have my own ideas, which everyone does. Everyone has their own voice, their own message. And then I had Larry Levine on my podcast, and it was amazing. I had Bob Berg on my podcast, and it was amazing because there's all these different perspectives. Everyone has a different idea. And so what you're about to hear is the conversation, the first one of many. We're going to do many of these together where we both just want to change the way sales is done. As you're here in this conversation, we both didn't receive formal training. We both had our knocks and the things that we thought you had to do to be successful. We both have experiences with what other people try to do to be successful in sales. That's just gross, just literally gross. And so hopefully you'll tune into this. Hopefully you found this episode. Even if this is the first time you've ever heard my podcast and you're just joining for the first time, I hope you subscribe. But if nothing else, I want you to take from this that there is another way to sell. There is another way to approach persuading someone to take an action in everyday life, in what you do, in sales, in business, in a relationship, whatever that might be. I hope you understand that there's another way, or it reinforces the things that you're doing and you just need to do more of it to be more successful in sales and make more money by helping more people. That's my goal. So here you go. Here's the conversation I had with Jeff Kerchek. I've got a special fun thing planned. If you're just tuning in, let me catch you up on what has happened. If you're a long time or you saw this yesterday, this is something different, totally not in my regular calendar of events I do on the lives. But when I talk to Jeff, who's right next to me, whichever way he is virtually on your screen, I was like, we've got to do a live broadcast together. And here is why. So as you may have saw in the intro, I wrote a book called Selling with Authentic Persuasion. He wrote a book called Authentic Selling, literally came out around the same time. Mine was August and yours was September, Jeff?
December.
Of 2020. Yeah. So right in that same time frame. If anyone saw my post that I made leading up to this,
as soon as we chatted, I was like, this is just like when Armageddon and Deep Impact came out in the same year and everyone thought somebody must have copied each other. But like, it was the universe saying we need two asteroid killing movies. And then like for us, it was literally just like the universe said, we need more authentic sales influence in the world. And I was like, we've got to do this. Like, as soon as we chatted, I was like, let's do a live. Let's talk about it. Let's just put that out there and then see what happens. So people on my stream, if you're following me on LinkedIn, you know who I am. Jeff, for the people who may be tuning in that don't know who you are, why don't you share kind of your background? We'll get into the book, but first let's talk about your background.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jason. And I'm really glad that we found each other. I'm looking forward to doing this with you. I think we share similar ideas about sales and selling and how sellers should behave, really. But just to give a quick introduction to myself, my name is Jeff Kirchick. I was going to announce this tomorrow on LinkedIn. So I guess for now, the cat's out of the bag, but I'm taking a head of sales role at a company called DaVinci Energy on Thursday. I've been working in sales for a little over a decade. I spent a lot of my career, about 7.5 years, as one of the first employees and the head of sales at a company called Nextcaller, which was acquired by Pindrop Security back in March. As you pointed out, I've also written the book Authentic Selling, How to Use Principles of Sales in Everyday Life. There's this, an associated online course for SDRs called Weirder Than Waldo. Enjoyed doing a lot of different mentorship types of things within the sales community, and I enjoy being mentored by people in the sales community, and enjoy things like this, you know, the opportunity to network with other like-minded professionals, share ideas, learn from each other's mistakes, and so on. And I guess last but not least, as you can see, based on the photo behind me, I'm based in Boston, Massachusetts, very proud Boston sports fan. Hope that doesn't turn off half the audience. Can't help where you're born. So that's a little bit about myself.
Can't help where you're born. You can help who you still root for, right? Maybe not what you were brought up to root for, but we can save that for another time before we totally divide the audience. Maybe it's too late. I don't know. I can see people are just dropping off like in mass, right?
Yeah, exactly.
In mass, huh? Yeah. And I love all that stuff that you're talking about. And for people that are tuning in, so here's what we want to do. We want to talk about sales. We want to talk about his focus on the authentic selling side, my authentic persuasion piece, you know, just why, how that came about. Really what I want to put out there as well is like how this is an effective, successful strategy and not a sales pitch for either him or I or our books, but more of just our passion, desire to get this kind of influence and content out there, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, but that's, you know, it's more of like, how do we help change the way sales is done from the way it is? So people tuning in, whether you're on LinkedIn, you're on Facebook, or you're on YouTube right now, please put a comment, say hello. If you're friends with Jeff, say hello to him, or if you're in my network, just want to hear from you. Also, what I would love to hear from people as they're, you know, as you're tuning in, if you want to leave the comment, if you want to put it in there so we can see it, is what do you think of when you hear authentic selling, selling with authentic persuasion, just those terms, right? And do you agree? Do you like that? Do you dislike that? Is it a turn on? Is it a turn off for selling effectiveness? I think that's always interesting. I know that I think we talked about this last week. I have had some interesting responses when I told people about the book I was writing. And then when it came out, people who didn't like it or disagreed with the word choices, some that really loved it and some that were, you know, not a big fan. So let's talk about, and then for me, I mean, my short version of my story was I grew up in California. I recently moved to Florida, but I was a very late bloomer, especially when it came to sales. Like, I did not want anything in a sales career. I did not want to get into sales. I did not want to deal with people. In fact, I chose marine biology and tagging sharks over people as the safest and best way to go. Something that seemed way, way safer, right? And I can picture one time, it's like the pinnacle of that previous life, where I was standing on a 21-foot boat. I'm the youngest guy on the crew. I'm probably like 20 years old at the time. My job is to keep the sharks from eating the bait, because if they eat the bait, then there's no reason for them to stay around. Then we can't tag them for the research studies. At one point, I'm standing on a 21-foot boat and we're surrounded by three 18-foot sharks circling us. And that was still a better, smarter career choice than people. Right. So just let that sink in. So for me, I got into sales when I was 27 in the mortgage business. I didn't even think it was sales. I didn't call myself a salesperson. I thought I was just helping people with mortgages. At the time in 2002, it was pure order taking. So literally it was the height of the real estate boom. People just wanted houses, wanted to refi. Rates were good. Not like they are now, but they were historically low at that point. And I still blew many chances at closing deals, but I still didn't think I was in sales. And then it wasn't until years later when I realized what sales really was about, then got into working inside telephone. I was raised always face-to-face sales when I got into it, never do anything over the phone. And then I worked at companies where it was just all over the phone, and had to believe, had to see that it was possible and then believe it, and then built systems around that so that non-natural born salespeople like myself could be successful with processes and systems, which is basically what led to writing the book, is what I've seen all these years, right? So what about for you? What was the spark where you're like, okay, I want to write a book, and this is the part that's different from most people out there, is actually did it, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people, I talk to a lot of people like, oh yeah, I should also write a book. Oh, I also want to write a book. Oh, okay, well, you should do it. Yeah, I don't know. It seems like a lot of work. But you did it, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can say I didn't start with tagging sharks. I have a different path, but I will say that's really cool. When I was a little kid, I always thought that I'd want to be a marine biologist. So I might have to talk to you about that on a different LinkedIn Live episode or something.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, like, I think there's some context behind me growing up that probably helps here. I mean, When I went to college for English and creative writing, I didn't have that purpose when I went to college, but that's what I ended up
cheating. Come on.
Yeah. So I had to write a senior thesis at Princeton, which was like a set of short stories. And like, that's something I was really passionate about when I was in school. So I've always wanted to get into writing. My long-term dream is to become a screenwriter. And so writing a book about sales was a way for me to kind of dip my toe into the writing waters without taking too much of a risk, because it was married to the work that I've been doing. Jason, your question about kind of like what's the straw that broke the camel's back here? We had a pandemic that happened, that certainly gave me some free time to sit at home and to, cross some things off my wish list. And I think during that, and I think even still today, and I don't want to talk about politics much here because it's probably going to create a lot of disagreement, but
let's draw the line with your Boston.
Exactly.
Let's draw that one line. Let's leave other lines for some.
Yeah, exactly. I think like one thing everyone will agree on though, is just that our dialogue in general has become pretty bad. Right. I think I noticed, mm-hmm. During the pandemic, people were just not very kind to one another. And, it was very common, for example, on my social media pages for people to be calling each other names and, disagreeing about things. We live in a very tense, world right now. And it's hard for people to have really productive conversations. And I thought to myself, if everyone was more like had the attitude and mindset of a salesperson, in other words, like you're okay with getting your ideas rejected. Your goal isn't to be right. Your goal is to seek to understand and ask good questions. You're used to being rejected, having your ideas rejected constantly. If more people had this mindset, we'd have much better conversations. There'd be much less tension, right? If people saw themselves as salespeople in everything that they do, whether it's like you and me, Jason, like actual salespeople, or, even a marine biologist has to sell their own ideas to people in their job. They just don't think of it that way. And you said when you were doing mortgages, you didn't think of yourself as a salesperson. You kind of just thought you were helping people. And that's common. A lot of salespeople don't view themselves as salespeople, just as many non-salespeople in the more overt sense don't think of themselves as salespeople. So I think that's kind of where I got the idea, is like, how do we get people to think with this mindset? Because maybe it would make us more productive in how we talk to one another.
Yeah. There's so much that it makes my brain think. One, right, the subtitle of your book about every day in sales and what you just said about, like, you know, being in sales and every aspect. I mean, my previous podcast, when it first started, my main podcast, it was called the Sales Experience Podcast before I rebranded it as the Authentic Persuasion Show when the book came out. Mm-hmm. The way I finished every episode for the first, three seasons was everything in life is sales, right? And people will remember the experience you gave them, which tied in the sales experience part. But it's true. Everything in life is sales. Like you want your manager to agree on your idea, or you want your team to follow what you say, or you're selling something directly, or you want to get your significant other to pick, you know, agree with the movie you want to go to, or the dinner you want to do, or the food, right? Like, mm-hmm. There's some aspect of sales and persuasion in that. And you could go controlling and forceful, or you could go persuading and authentic, understanding those things. But I agree. I mean, I think most people don't understand that literally it's all sales. I think the problem is, or the reason why people don't think that, which is what you were alluding to, is that sales, the word sales, when people hear that, it has such a gross manipulative connotation, mm-hmm. that when people hear sales, they think literally used car, plaid jacket, tie, pushy car salesperson, right? Like, it's funny too, because I have dealt with a bunch of younger people, right, in generations where they don't know that archetype of the used car salesperson, right? Like, they didn't have an experience of going to a car lot and then having this used car person in the jacket, right? That mode, right? Because they haven't bought a car, or now they just ordered from a vending machine and it just shows up because they don't want to deal with gross salespeople. But everyone still has that. I mean, I've dealt with, I don't know if you have, but I've dealt with people overseas, like in call centers, not in the US. And I say used car salesperson, and they all know what that, they all can see it, right? They can visualize it. And I think the problem is that people think that is sales, and that's the only way to do sales. And it's either you are that kind of salesperson, or you're not in sales, right? Or you can't be successful, right?
Yep. No, and I agree. And I think that, I think there's so many real world examples of where people can look at others who, like, I think there's so many people out there that you can look at, and it becomes very obvious which people you're naturally more going to gravitate to than others, right? So, like, for example, one of the, I don't mention this in my book, it's actually more so in like interviews after the fact. I talk a lot about like Dennis Rodman as a good example. You know, I don't know, are you familiar? Do you know
Dennis Rodman,
the NBA player? Yeah. So like,
yep.
He's a strange guy, right? There's like no doubt about it. Like, you know, I think he wore a wedding dress down Fifth Avenue, and
yeah,
you know, he just,
I think he was married to Madonna for a minute, or dated her or something.
Yeah. Know. He was like going off to Vegas in the middle of the NBA season. He's like best friends with the North Korean dictator.
Yeah.
But the thing with Dennis Rodman is like, none of that was an act. Like, he wasn't doing that for fame and attention. There's real stories from like NBA, like Kevin Garnett has a story where Dennis Rodman just like after a game is in combat boots in the gym, running on the treadmill after a game, talking smack to him. Like, that's just a weird guy. Like, you know, like, that's not like a thing that the media sees. That's a story that came out like 20 or 30 years after the fact. And okay. Where I'm going with this is like, there are people in society that have built, like, he was almost as famous as Michael Jordan, even though he was not even half the player. He was a good player, but yeah. Michael Jordan's the best, right? But this guy had just as much fame and accolade. And even today, I mean, his documentary and Michael Jordan's documentary came out like the same time last year during the pandemic, right? The point being is that he's a great example of how authenticity can really pull people in. Now, Dennis Rodman isn't a salesperson. He's an NBA player. Right.
Right.
His job isn't to sell you on something, but think about how much money he probably has made and how much respect he's commanded respect from the leader of a country that wants nothing to do with anyone here. I'm not saying that that's a good thing. It's probably a bad thing. But the thing is that it's so infectious, this authenticity, that it commands respect from people that's very hard to get respect from. And so I think that's I use that, and there's other examples I could give as well, but you know, when you see someone who's overtly not in sales. We have these role models, these people that we look up to. A lot of times we don't look up to people just because they're successful. You know, we often really look up to people because they're honest, right? They're honest with themselves about their own failures. We respect people when we feel like we can trust them, and we trust them when they're honest. Right. And so, I think that when you see people like Dennis Rodman and many other, you know, role models that we have who are earning attention and accolades and fame largely due to their authenticity, you can see how this doesn't apply just to salespeople. It applies to anyone in any role, even as a professional athlete or politician or marine biologist or what have you.
Yeah. And I think one of the parts that I see a lot, and it's an internal struggle that I have even still all the time, right? It's the part of my brain that knows that we as a species have gotten to where we are because we are a tribal communal society that works together, right? We are a species that works together as a group and then has dominated for good or for evil, good and evil, over this planet and everything on it because we work together. And we do that intentionally. And if you don't fit in, or if you do something to violate the trust of the tribe, back not too long ago in our history as a species, you would get kicked out of the tribe and left for dead. Right. Like, mm-hmm. you could not survive by yourself against the elements that were trying to kill you, because everything was trying to kill you until recent times when it's pretty safe. Other than people texting while they're driving or being distracted. Like, there's most things, you know, most people are safe in their lives for the most part. Right. Pending this pandemic that really shook the world up. But our brain wants to be part of the tribe. And because we have very little else to worry about, I know for me and what I've seen with other people is the thought of being authentic, the thought of being who they are, the thought of not even going to the extreme of a Dennis Rodman, but doing the things like that they would want to do and then being judged. And then that part of their brain that thinks, if I get judged, I'll get kicked out of the tribe, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same reason I think why most people's number one fear is public speaking over death, is because that primal part of the brain is worried about being rejected and kicked out of the tribe, because that's the extension of just being made fun of, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what you're talking about there is that authentic piece. We're drawn to it. A lot of people are afraid to do that because they think, I can't succeed, or I can't be okay, or people won't like me, or I can't succeed in sales. If I'm authentic, I've got to act like this person, or I've got to do these things or say these things or play this part, or, you know, do X, Y, and Z. I've heard it all, instead of like being themselves. And then yeah. when I explain that to people and they're like, well, but what if people don't like it? I'm like, people can sense when you're fake and phony and trying to trick them. If you're being authentic and you, people will understand it. The second part is what you call, you know, authentic selling. I call it authentic persuasion, which is you have to do something. You have to, can't just be all authentic, because if you're all authentic, everyone likes you, but you're broke living under a bridge with lots of people who like you. You have to like do something as an action step in that process, but it starts with the authenticity.
Yeah, no, I agree with that 100%. I'll give you an example, actually, something that happened to me today. I had someone reach out to me under the guise of, hey, I'm like new to sales, I wanna network with you, whatever. So I said, sure, I'll get on the phone and chat. It ended up being, I was able to tell pretty quick that, you know, I think this was a sales pitch and the person wanted to sell me something. Now, look, yeah. I was cool about it. I didn't, you know, I didn't like throw a hissy fit or anything like that. But in my mind, mentally, I'm in a place where I'm reticent to really take the pitch very seriously, because I have a feeling that there wasn't a authentic outreach approach there, and that there right. was maybe something that was lacking in the intention. And like, you know, this person's like, think relatively new to sales and whatever, so they'll figure it out, and maybe something I could help them with, but that's a good example. And like, you know, Jason, the thing with the shared values and the tribalism and things like that, that's, I think that was a really important point that you made. You know, if you think about every war, I know I keep going off to these like these grand
no this is perfect
yeah you think about every war that's ever happened throughout human history, it's been different governing philosophies, people that look different than us. We want to conquer them because we don't look the same. I mean, people, it's always something stupid, right? But it's always because it's other people that don't share our values or are not like us, right? And so there's this human urge to constantly want to associate with people who share our values.
Yeah.
And to some extent we should fight that in certain cases, right? Like with certain things, but with other like actual ideas and values that we have, those are actually really important to us. And so when I teach people how to do cold outreach, that's the first thing I tell them is like, how find what values you share with your buyer. It's very important for you to relate on a level that you guys share certain values. And that's why it's important that you meet. And Jason, now you reached out to me, you know, you weren't trying to really sell me anything. I guess you were trying to maybe sell me on the idea of us doing stuff like this. I don't think it was really hard sell for you, but you had to reach out to me out of the blue. And your approach was, hey, I think we have similar values around our selling philosophy. I think we have similar ideas. It would be great if we could brainstorm about our ideas and share our ideas. We both wrote books. We clearly both care about sharing ideas with people, right? But that was an effective way for you to communicate with me. I would have, you know, you could have said anything and I would have been excited to meet with you. But the point remains that, you know, you understand that this is the right way to do your outreach, is that you have to identify what is the shared value between you and that individual, because that's what resonates with them. Nobody cares about what you do or what you sell. They care about why you do it. They care about, do we share the same values and ideas around why this is important? So I think that's a really important point you made back a moment.
So much stuff in there. And I hope this individual you're talking about does get it and figure out that doesn't work. My concern, the one who, you know, did the, let's just call it bait and switch. Let's just call it what it was, right? It was an intentional bait and switch where they wanted to act like one thing, get enough trust to get their foot in the door to then pitch you on something, right? Mm-hmm. And I can say it's intentional bait and switch. We don't know the person. We don't know really what it is, but I've seen it enough times. I've been on the receiving end enough times. I've been in call centers where people are trying that and they're like pretending to be one thing. I've been taught that before, or people who tried to teach me like, hey, do this. And then once you get in, then look for this opportunity and go in for the kill. And I hope that that person gets it. I hope that person changes. Unfortunately, the pattern in the world shows that they won't, unless people like you and I, people like the rest of this kind of community who's putting out this kind of content and raising awareness. Like, it's really raising awareness that there's another way to help persuade people to make some kind of decision that doesn't have to involve gross ass bait and switch manipulation tactics. Right. Yep. I'll just call it like it is. Right. You know, and being able to do it. And I hope that person changes. I think what's interesting / scary is the fact that that just keeps getting handed down. Right. Either that person walked into that role and said, hey, this is a good way to go, which I doubt it because they don't know anything. Right. It's like, do you blame the kid for how they grow up, or do you blame the parents? Mm-hmm. Right. At some point, a kid is a kid and they don't know better, and they're a reflection of the parents until they get around other people who might change them. But it's the parent. So what's this manager telling them? What's the company telling them? How are they being trained? And what's that process they're being run through that does that? That's the part that scares me most, is somebody keeps teaching people this. And I've talked to enough of other consultants, trainers, people who run call centers, like, they just, no matter what, it just keeps perpetuating.
Yeah. And I've had to be, and look, in the interest of practicing what I preach, I'll be vulnerable and admit the mistakes that I've made.
Right?
I've maybe not been as clear with certain reps that I've had about, you know, when implementing my strategy, and I've had to correct people because, you know, I talk about this in my book a little bit, but I had a very overzealous rep. He's actually doing quite well now. He learned a lot from his earlier, you know, mistakes when he was working for me, but he would kind of take some liberties in terms of what he presented as reality. So he would reach out to certain people and say like, you know, you're a Kansas City Royals fan. I'm a Royals fan. But then meanwhile, on his Facebook page, he's got like a Red Sox hat on. Right. And like he got caught, you know, fibbing a couple times. And I had to explain to him, I'm like, look, I like that you're being creative. I like that you're personalizing your outreach, but you can't do it at the expense of of honesty, right? You need to be honest in everything that you do. I mean, I went like, and I talked about this in one of my LinkedIn posts recently. I went to this pretty austere all boys high school in the Boston area called Roxbury Latin. It's an all boys school, 50 boys in a class, small school. The student handbook, the number of the first thing that they tell you is honesty is expected in all dealings. That's the number one line in the student handbook. And there were students that got suspended and in some cases expelled for lying. And I'm not kidding. This for like lying about something, usually related to cheating or something of that nature, but they would get expelled. Like it was taken very seriously that if you did not tell the truth, that you were out. And that I get, maybe I have some trauma from that, but it stuck with me for a long time that honesty is critical. And I try my best to bring that to my sales life. And one thing that I do, and Jason, I'd be curious to hear if this is something you do as well. I often will like neg myself at the beginning of a pitch. Not because I'm trying to pull like some weird manipulative trick over somebody, but because I think it's important that people know about what are the things that we can't do and what problems we can't solve for them. Mm-hmm. I like to get out in front of that. Todd Capone wrote The Transparency Sale. He talks a lot about that, this idea that you actually start with like the negative things. But here's the thing that it does, Jason. It makes it so that I'm a very believable person for the rest of that meeting, right? Because I'm going to spend the next 95% of the meeting talking about all the great things and all the ways that we can help, probably, right? And so it actually gives some credibility, because how many salespeople are coming in and talking about what they can't do for the first 5 minutes? It kind of sets you up as a credible person for the bulk of the meeting. I'm not saying I do this every time, and it's not like I go in and like a formula where I'm just going to neg myself so that people trust me. It's just something I do naturally from time to time when I'm doing discovery and I understand there might be certain things we can't solve. I'm very upfront about that. I don't like ignore that and pretend that it doesn't exist. And I'm just curious, is that, have you found yourself doing that from time to time where you kind of get out in front of a potential objection because, you know, you just feel compelled. You just want to be honest about it.
Yes. And I'm going to answer that. But for people tuning in, I just want to catch everyone up. If you're just tuning in, so Jeff and I are having a conversation. We both wrote books with the word selling and authentic in them, in the titles. We've come together. We're jumping on here. We're chatting, just kind of running through our thoughts that come up as we went through this. If you're tuning in and you haven't, put a comment in there, say hello. Let us know what your thoughts are around authentic selling, persuasion, if you agree with those terms, if you disagree. It's always fun to hear people who disagree, because then it's just semantics. They don't like persuasion. They like some other word. They don't like authenticity. They like transparency, right? It's usually comes down to the word, not the intent. So appreciate everyone tuning in. Like for me, I'll speak for me, but I think I'll also speak for you, Jeff, is that like everyone tuning in now or in the replay, you can also leave comments. This is why we do it, to help put these seeds out there, as David Meltzer would say, like plant seeds under trees that you'll never sit under, to just hopefully change the way it's done. So I just want to catch everyone up here, little stop in the middle. So many things, like every time you're talking, I'm just like, yes. And this like bad sales mode where I'm like, I'm not even thinking about like, I'm listening, but I'm also thinking about what I want to say. So I try not to do that as a host anyway. But yeah, I think the biggest thing with that, I think, is to always set the expectations. One of the things I wrote about in there, and I train people on all the time, is there's two parts. One is set the expectation of what's going to happen or what you're going to do next, because people do not like mysteries or surprises, because they're always, especially if they're dealing with a salesperson, which is inherently dangerous and fraught with challenges or issues or things they're worried about, then you want to let them know what's coming up, because otherwise their brain is just thinking about, okay, where's the gotcha? When is he going to do this? When are they going to try to pitch me this? When are they going to hit me with this? Right. Kind of like your story from earlier today about the person who, you know, got on the call because they're new in sales and just wanted to pick your brain. Right. Like in those moments, you have enough of those and you go, all right, when's it coming? Just waiting. I'm just waiting for this thing to come. Just hit me with this bait and switch BS. Just bring it, right? And so the thing to keep in mind, if you're a salesperson at any level in selling anything, B2C, B2B, it doesn't matter. The people you're dealing with have been customers for some length of time before interacting with you. And I promise they've had bad experiences. So they're always on guard, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's just the thing. It's just, unless you're selling to maybe teenagers, everyone else has had an experience or heard about an experience or watch a family member or watched a terrible sales movie and realized sales is bad. You're a salesperson. This is potentially bad. I got to watch out. So when you set that expectation, you said nagging on it. Like when you say, hey, here's what we're going to do. The next part is discovery. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. I want to find out if this is a good fit. It might not be a good fit. And well, usually what I'll tell people is, just last week I was speaking to somebody and this was their situation and it wasn't a good fit. And then I told them to go a different option. And I told them to do X, Y, and Z. Depending on what I'm selling, I'll tell them exactly, like go file bankruptcy or do this or go talk to an attorney or, you know, talk to this tech provider. And then they know. And then they go, okay, great. Now I know what's going to happen next. Then I know what's going to happen after that segment, which is I'm going to tell you if it's a good fit. And if it's a good fit, I'll tell you why. And I'll tell you why I think it's important for you. And then they know. The other thing, which is what I love that you said, is how most salespeople don't do this, is my number one rule. If anyone is struggling in sales, the first thing they should do is stop doing anything that you think a salesperson should do. Mm-hmm. Stop doing any of it. When in doubt, don't be a salesperson, right? And salesperson being in the terms of the gross stuff we talked about in the beginning, where it's the bad connotation, right? Hey, Jeff, how are you doing today? Oh, that's great. How's the weather there? Oh, Kansas City, huh? Oh, yeah. I'm like, don't. You sound gross. Like you're setting off alarms like crazy. Most people in sales who are trying to manipulate or push someone to buy, they got to meet their numbers. They're not going to do anything that might be seen as harming their chances of closing that sale, right? Mm-hmm. They're not going to say, this might not be a good fit for you. I don't even know if you're going to like this, unless they're doing that as like a takeaway manipulation. Otherwise, if they really mean it, they're worried that that's not going to work unless they have the confidence and understanding of their job. So I think that's so important. And then it's interesting hearing you talk about the guy who's talking about, like, you know, oh, you're in Kansas City. Oh, I love the Royals. Like, oh, this, like, I think that's what gets people in trouble mentally, where they think that's what it takes to be in sales. Mm-hmm. Like to be effective in sales, I have to find this common thing. I have to pretend like I care. I have to get them to like me about their thing, and then we're good, right? Instead of being like, oh, you're in Kansas City. I've never been there. Like, tell me about it. Like, that is okay, but unconfident salespeople won't go that route because then they think, oh, well, you're not in Kansas City. I might not like you.
Yeah.
Tell me about Kansas City. Like, I've never been there. Where should I go? What should I do?
Yeah. And it comes down to this, this idea that, to your point, Jason, about like, don't do the thing that you think you should do. Your intuition is to be liked, right? We talked about this tribalism. You want to be accepted in the tribe. You want to be liked. But it's actually, I give an example early in my book. I'm like, if you're going to have, let's say you have a kid and you need to have a babysitter for your kid, and you can pick a friend of yours who you like to go party with in Las Vegas or your mom, who are you going to pick? You know, and the answer is probably your mom. You probably have your mom babysitting. Now, who do you like more? You know, you probably love your mom more, which is your mom, but like, who do you like to hang out with more? You know, you like to hang out with your mom, or do you like to go to Vegas with your friend? You probably prefer to go to Vegas with your friend, but that's not what matters when you're entrusting somebody with something important, right? What matters is, who do I trust? And this is the key thing that salespeople, like to your point about the weather and the Kansas City Royals or whatever.
Yeah.
We have this idea that if we're liked, that people will buy from us, that if we tell funny jokes, if we take them out to play golf, if we get them a steak dinner, if we're liked, that they will do business with us. And that's actually not it at all. It's if we are trusted, they will do business with us. That's the key thing. You could be someone that actually they don't like. I know I'm going to repeat this again because people need to hear this. You can be patently unlikable, but if you are trustworthy, you're going to have a better chance of closing a deal with than somebody who's likable and somebody who feels like maybe they're being a little fake. Because when people are making important buying decisions, it really comes down to trust because people's jobs are on the line, their bonuses are on the line. And unfortunately, when it comes to someone's livelihood, it doesn't matter how likely, how likable you are. It matters on whether the percentage likelihood in someone's brain that you're going to actually deliver on what you promise. And that's a key thing for people to understand. And the way that I define it in my book is, you know, treating people like the way you would treat your best friend or a family member. And the way that I've actually been kind of defining it since I wrote the book and the way that I actually wish I defined it when I wrote the book was presenting an honest version of yourself. You know, when you present an honest version of yourself, even if you are a bad version of yourself, someone who's not very likable, but if you're presenting an honest version of yourself, people will feel that. We have this, like you said, Jason, we have a way of sensing when we have this kind of this BS, you know, filter. People can sense when you're being yourself. And if you're owning it, even if you're not a likable person, people respect that, right? I mean, Dennis, you know, I go back to Dennis Rodman. I don't want to use him over and over again, but he's a good example. A counterpoint would be, you know, sorry to any Alec Baldwin fans, but I think his wife pretended to be Spanish or something. And that became like a big thing. And then she got canceled because she's not really Spanish. And like, that's an example of someone very famous and has a lot of money and has a lot of things going for her who no one wants really to much to do with her anymore because they don't perceive that she's being honest. Right. So that's something that I think is pretty critical in all this.
Well, and I would semi debate it and maybe argue a little bit against. I think trust is the most important thing, right? And we can talk more about that and why that is from a deep psychological standpoint, what the whole goal of sales is and what you're up against no matter what. But we both agree that trust is important. It's super important. I think being unlikable or not being liked or not focusing on some level of like can work if you have a lot of credibility, a lot of trust, and or based on what you're selling, you own the market, right? And so I'll use an example because this is what I talk about when I talk about the trust factor and the like factor is it's like doctors who have terrible bedside manner, no rapport, no engagement, no like, no empathy, but they have all the certificates on the wall. They have all the accolades. They are accolades. They are the best brain surgeon in the country. Whether you like them or they're nice to you or they made you feel good might not matter in that moment because they are such an expert and they have what you want. And that's the key to your survival potentially, right? Or the best knee surgeon. And you might not like their bedside manner, but that's when you own the market and you have the credibility. What I would say is most salespeople don't have a corner. They don't have the credibility that can pull off just being an ass. And most companies don't own the market. And if they do, you can actually tell that when I engage with their salespeople, because they act like they own the market and they act like you don't need to like them and they don't care about you because they own the market, right? Let's look at most Apple experiences, right? Like standing in line, they own the market. You want an Apple phone, guess where you get it from? Otherwise, good luck. Like we don't have to be nice to you because all you guys will just come storming in to get a phone, right? We don't have to care. We don't have to like you. And so I think that's the part that where some like, it's got to be authentic, transparent. You know, like I said, I had a guy on my podcast last year. He's like, I hate the word authentic, which made for a fun show on the Authentic Persuasion.
Oh, boy.
His big thing was transparency. And his big thing that I loved, which is true for me, another one of those things I would have put in the book if I could have wrote it again, or, you know, these things you and I learn after you write a book, you're like, dang it. Ah, that would have been good. Is for him, what he said was, there's no question when, like, let's say for me, like when you meet me and when we talk, you know what you're getting and there's nothing else, right? There's no hidden stuff. There's no different me. I'm the same. And I even enjoy taking that to the next level. It's like, if you meet me at the store or we're in a sales call, or we're in a business, or I'm consulting or training you, I'm still the same person, right? Like, not even too much different language, because I'm pretty simple, but like, I am the same transparent person no matter what. And it's just there. I think the liking is important. I love what you said about having some commonality that you're going for. And at some point, that's great. That warms things up on the road to trust, but you're not there to be their friends, right? You're not there to sell via happy hours and schmoozing and storytelling and jokes. Like, you need to be a professional, right? Like, no one wants a really funny but crappy doctor.
Right. Yeah. Right? I agree. And by the way, I think we're on the same page. I wouldn't recommend trying to be unlikable at all.
No, I know.
So the good news, Jason, to what you're saying, I think, is that there's inherently a link between authenticity and likability, because even if you're somebody who might be very different from someone else, so in other words, not someone that they would naturally like on their own, if you're being honest about who you are and they perceive that you are an honest person, there's inevitably going to be some connection or correlation between your authenticity and your likability, right? Like, even if you have very different things that you like to do for fun or whatever, like, if you're just perceived as somebody who isn't fake, like, we just really don't like people who aren't genuine, right? If you think about all the people that we really worship and that we really look up to, like in sports, for example, people stopped, I joked about being a Patriots fan at the beginning. People don't like rooting for the Patriots because they win all the time, right? Like, what people like is the underdog, right? So people used to like the Patriots many years ago because Tom Brady was this like sixth round draft pick. He was, Mr. Nobody. He became a superstar. He was like chubby in the draft and he became like the best, football player. So in those early years, it was actually like fun to root for them because we like rooting for the underdog. We like rooting for people who don't have it made, right? And that's true even of people who don't succeed. I think there's a lot of time you'll find that we are often like rooting for people who made a mistake or something, but owned it and said like, okay, now I'm going to do better next time. What really bothers us is when people make a mistake, but then they pretend that they didn't make a mistake, right? Yeah. Because that's like not being authentic, right? That's like knowing deep down that there's a part of you that needs to be accountable to something that happened, but being unwilling to be honest about it publicly, right? We really just have this natural appreciation for people that are honest with themselves, even if they fail. I mean, just think about how many times there's people that have failed, they've done bad things or they failed at something and then they resolve to do better next time. Like, we always prefer to root for those people than people who have already won, right?
Yeah.
So it's in our DNA to want to be, to like people if they're being authentic, right? So I think there's like kind of a natural correlation, interestingly, between authenticity and how well liked or how well respected you'll be by your peers.
So talking about the book, because this is something I don't have a specific list in my mind, but I can think of a handful off the top of my head. So for people that don't understand it and think about writing a book, let's take a little detour because I think this part is fun. For me, it was a 2-year journey and I had a coach. Like, I was on the process of writing all kinds of books. And then I hired a coach because I tried to write one years ago. I got in my head, who am I to write a book? Gave up. Got myself a coach, someone to give me the roadmap, like the mentor stuff you're talking about. Like, somebody who's been there can help me get there. Still a 2-year process, partially because I wrote it, printed it, read it. It was garbage. I threw it away, 60,000 words, waited like 3 months, wrote it again from scratch, and then started the editing process, which was brutal. In my head. So it was a journey, right? It takes a long time. At some point you have to stop writing and stop editing because you just have to get it printed, right? Otherwise you'll have this never ending unfinished piece of work that will never be a masterpiece and it will never be perfect, right? I would contest. in that process, what happens is as soon as you're done editing and it goes to print, you're like, oh, I should have done this. I should have put this in there. What else did I do? Or like probably for you and I start doing all these podcasts. I start talking to people. I'm talking to more companies. I'm doing more training and coaching. I'm like, dang it. Like that would have been a good chapter. I should have put that in there. Like it would have been a 600 page book if I had done that. For you, what comes to mind when you think like this, like, I wish I could go back and put this in there? Or maybe it's, what did you learn? So you put out the book, people can check it out. Obviously, you know, they can find your book. But like, what would you put in volume two? Right. What is it? What is it you didn't cover that as soon as it went to print, you're like, damn.
Yeah. I think that it's a great question. I've actually thought about like maybe doing a sequel at some point so that I can try to cover this. I think that there's a lot more real world applications that I wish that I had drawn upon as a means of trying to get the point across. So for example, like interviewing, like I think you could write even a whole book about job interviews. I mean, I don't really endeavor to do that because I don't know how much fun it would be, but I think I wish there was a chapter just about interviews, right? I mean, you're interviewing a lot of your life, you're interviewing for different things and you're interviewing people. So you need to understand what to look for, what questions to ask and how to answer certain questions. And I think even just the example of when you ask somebody in an interview, like what's your greatest flaw, you know, you're either going to get a real answer or you're going to get some concocted answer about something that's actually a positive, like
my greatest flaw is my work ethic and how hard I work and how much I care.
Exactly. It's like that's usually like the BS answer. And like I actually like honestly asked that question just to find out if I have an honest actor, right? Like that's that's why I'm trying to figure out like, are you going to tell me what you're actually like? And honestly, I'd rather that somebody tells me that they have like a flaw that I should actually be worried about. But then like some awareness about how they figured that out and what they're doing to solve it, then for them to just make up that there isn't.
But that's, and I want to hear more about what you put in the next book, but that's the thing you were talking about earlier, which is bringing up these things and being real. Mm-hmm. And as a salesperson, the kind of salesperson who's not going to need to be perfect and not going to lie and not just put on an act, but is who they are and knows that they're not perfect and they don't have to be perfect in order to win at selling.
Exactly right. Yeah. And I mean, and that's just like, you know, for interviews, that's like only one example, but I've even done, you know, mentorship stuff. And one of the reasons I really enjoy doing mentorship is because of the sincerity of the people who I mentor. You know, it takes a lot of humility to be mentored by someone else and to say that I need your help, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that attracts me to that. So I think that there's a lot of these real world applications for how people can ask for things, right? Like even if you were to ask someone to be a mentor for you, how would you go about that? There's a good way to do it, and there's probably a not so good way to do it. So those are the things that I wish I kind of got more in the weeds on that. How about yourself? I mean, are you thinking about a sequel here? Stuff that
I am working on the second one, and I already know what the next three are in my head. Right. I'm behind. I had wanted the second one to already be out this year, but busy with other stuff and didn't move that forward. Well, I love what you said too, and I think, you know, that sequel is important. I think the follow up is important. I think it's that constant, like you can't put everything in one book, and you realize things, like if anyone's done that where you've done a job or you've written something or whatever, and then you look back and like, oh, I could have done this, or I should have done this, or I should have included. I think we all do that, and I do that in micro moments where it's like at the end of the day, you reflect on a conversation, be like, oh, I should have said that, or that would have been a great thing to say. Like now imagine writing it in a book and then throwing it out there in the universe, right? And even though they say, and I heard this many times, is that no matter how many times it's edited and reviewed, there will still be typos. Yeah. I will tell you the three typos that I found as soon as it was printed just drive me crazy. Absolutely crazy. It's just the way it is, right? In the process. For me, my next book is not going to be filling in the gaps of what that is. But for me, the biggest things, it's tough because I really wanted to put more in there and some more specifics on the persuasion process. Since then, what I have developed is actually a contextual model framework called the Authentic Persuasion Pathway, which kind of what we were talking about with, you know, people want trust. It's because they're in their comfort zone. Change literally, like buying something new equals change, and change equals death. Like that's really all it comes down to in our primal part of our brain that's just worried about getting kicked out of the tribe, making the wrong decision, right? It wasn't too long ago that eating the wrong berry or whatever like could kill you because there was no medicine and you're toast. And so I built this framework, and I think if I could do it, it would be in there because that would make that more concise and help people with that roadmap. I balance that with the fact that my focus was more on the fundamentals and foundation that's more universal. The pathway is universal, but the big thing wasn't about tactics. It wasn't about say this or do this. It was like, you got to get the authentic part figured out first. Then you can focus on the fundamentals of persuasion. And then there's some intangibles. But yeah, I mean, there's the, you know, it's what I would have put more into is about that process where it's like super clear, take people on this journey. And I had the journey in my mind, but the way I wrote it was, here's parts of the journey. Maybe it was really good. Maybe it was a strategy on my side to leave it open for a next one. So I think the other thing too, like for me, I wrote the book, and I'd love to hear this. I wrote the book that I wish I had, but I also wrote the book for me in the way that I think out of my head. So there are some stories in it, but not like what you're talking about, even in this conversation. In sales, I will use some stories, but I don't generally pull a bunch of stories out of everywhere, you know, on this repertoire. And so the next one that I really want to write is taking selling with authentic persuasion and doing it more in a, you know, story mode, in a parable mode, where different people could then take it, right? Maybe people that aren't thinking like me, and they go, okay, all right, I'd rather read a story parable, and that's how I'm going to learn. That's what I want to do next with it, and then help people that look at the world that way versus me. Because I've had some people read and go, yeah, this is like a textbook. But other people are like, this is amazing. So it's all about how people like to learn.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. I'm looking forward to seeing it. We've got like, it's like Star Wars. You got like eight of these things coming out. Five total.
But definitely. And then, then I need some prequels in there. And then I need some prequels that suck, that everyone hates.
Yeah.
At least that makes the other one look good. So I will follow that same format. At some point I'll have like 18 of them and three that no one talks about.
Yeah. Well, that means you've got 15 good ones. So
that means there's 15 good ones.
That's awesome. I'm looking forward to seeing those.
Now, did you like one of the things they said, and I mentioned a minute ago, is, you know, if you're going to do it, or especially when you write a book, typically it's to write the book that you wish you had when you were in X, Y, and Z, or starting out in X, Y, and Z, right? In this case, where does that kind of motto fit in with you? Is that true? Or like, you've always done this thing? Like, how does that fit into where you started, what this would have done for you then, or, you know, for people starting out?
Yeah, I mean, it would have done a lot for me if I had had it starting out, because it was really a culmination of a lot of things that I learned through my own experience over, let's call it 10 plus years. That being said, a lot of what's in there is also the result of behavior that I exhibited on my own. I personally didn't go through a lot of formal sales training programs, which some would say is a bad thing. And I would say it was probably a good thing, because it helped me to embrace my own style and to figure out what worked for me, versus thinking about what is the thing that I need to say right now. In fact, one of the premises of my book about authenticity is that with the uptick of machine learning and AI, that it's going to be more important than ever to move away from these more formulaic approaches to sales, because theoretically, machines could adopt those programs. And what we have as humans that makes us uniquely differentiated from machines is obviously our humanity, right? So I would say that it was partially a result of a methodology that I've kind of embraced from the beginning, which is really just have no methodology. I know it sounds kind of bad, but a lot of it too is just stuff I learned. You know, I think, for example, this is very simple, but a lot of, whenever I ask people and I'm training young sales reps, what's the most important part of sales? They always think it's, you know, something to do with talking at the customer. They're, obviously the right answer is listening. You know, it's, you know, the most important thing in sales is listening. That's not something that I knew intuitively, but it is something that I do intuitively with my best friends or family members when they need help with something. I don't like talk over them to try to sell them on an idea. I just try to be helpful. And in order to be helpful, I have to ask them questions. Right. So, so I think that there are things that I learned through doing that are in there. And then there are also, you know, some of it was just the way that I was, but there's a lot in there that I wish that I knew, intuitively at the outset, because I think I did want to impress people when I was early in my sales career, and I wanted to be the funny guy and charismatic and whatever. And I wish that I would have learned early on back then that, yeah, that's nice, but it's not what gets you to the finish line. So
I love it. I think that's great. And I think there is that balance, right? I mean, no one knows there's no right way, right? But which is without that formal training, without, you know, being taught a certain way and groomed a certain way, you made your own, which then of course defaults to authentic as long as you're effective. There's a lot of people who default to their own thing that's not effective, but obviously what you're doing is effective. And I think that's the same thing for me. I realized in the process of writing my book that I have received 0 minutes of formal sales training. I have never, prior to being a consultant, I never worked at a company where they said, welcome, you're our new manager, you're a new salesperson, you're a new VP of sales, and we're going to put you through this training. Like, no one has formally ever told me how to overcome objections, how to read people, how to understand behavior, like how to follow this script. I got hired early on into companies. Actually, the first time I was a leader was because they fired the VP of sales and made me VP of sales and operations. And I wasn't a salesperson. I didn't want to be in sales, but I was operations. And then I was in charge. And then it was like, okay, now figure out how to fix this thing and let's work on it. And then from there on, I was hired and they always assumed I knew. So it's totally self-taught, which painful at times, but I think beneficial, because then it's like figuring out what works for me and for others, seeing hundreds and hundreds of people come and go, fortunately and unfortunately, you understand, like, here's what works, here's what doesn't work, like in the real world, not in the sales world, but in the real world. So I think that's great. And I think that's a perfect place to stop. I appreciate everyone for tuning in. Thanks, people, for joining. So we're going to do this. I know we're going to do this again, especially because Jeff just got his LinkedIn Live between the time we thought about this and we did it today. So next time we're going to have this conversation, we're going to continue it. He's going to be running the show, so it's going to be under his. So that's going to be a blast. So if you're in my network, make sure to connect with him, follow him, so you get alerts when that pops up. And if people want to find out more, obviously you're on LinkedIn. You just mentioned a job change early on when we started. So LinkedIn's probably the best place, especially if people are seeing this. I'm assuming the book is on Amazon, is all those places. Anything else for people, like if they want to reach out to you?
Yeah, jeff.kirchick@gmail.com. Please feel free to do that. Likewise, folks, if there's folks in my network that are here watching this, I hope they'll follow you, Jason. And you and I are going to schedule something to do this again soon, hopefully next week or the week after. So I'm definitely looking forward to those future discussions.
Yeah. And for anyone watching this, obviously you can get a hold of me through LinkedIn. Also, jasoncutter.com is a great hub for all I do with the podcast and the books and different stuff. And then email me, jason@cutterconsultinggroup.com. And this has been a blast. Exactly what I thought it was going to be, and exactly how I knew the fact that we weren't going to have enough time to cover one portion of the things on my list. But either way, Jeff, thanks for being up for this. Obviously with an abundance mindset of two people who literally wrote something similar that focus on the same thing, but just want to change the world. I appreciate what that means, that most people might not recognize or see that, like, we both just want to change the way sales is done. And it's not about competition. It's not about you and I, it's about that we just need to do it. So I appreciate you for that. And thanks for being a part of this.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right, everybody. And we'll catch you next time when Jeff and I do this, but in the reverse. Until then, have a good day.
Thanks for tuning into the Authentic Persuasion Show. If you found value in this episode, please do two things. Subscribe so you can get each new episode, and share this episode with anyone else you know in sales. Together, we can help shift the way sales is done. And if you want to find out more information about how to transform your sales career, or you want help with shifting your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, go to jasoncutter.com. Don't forget that everything in life is sales, and I will catch you on the next episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show.